Hello, welcome to the second of the two podcasts created by Lafayette College's 10 Ways to Know Nature first-year seminar classes. It's time for the FYS Newsroom. I'm your host, Scott, and today we have a special report planned for our glorious fans. It's time to ask Mother Earth the hard-hitting questions. How do we come to know nature? In what ways do we interact with the natural world? And how do we perceive it because of those ways? Now, this is a huge question, much larger in scope than you may think. You see, nature is dynamic, and it's not just the pretty pictures you see in National Geographic. Nature is everywhere, and it can be analyzed in a number of ways. Today, I plan to enlighten you on how we come to know nature through art, science, technology, food, and consumerism. It's a big task. And to help me, I've assembled a crack team of reporters. I've also employed a few local radio shows and blogs to present our findings as well. Get ready to see the natural world in a whole new light as we present how we, as humans, come to know nature in many different ways. To begin, I've sent ace reporters Molly and Olivia all the way to Lascaux, France. There they will investigate the area's ancient caves, as well as discuss our ancestors' earliest foray into art. These two will identify the relationship between nature and art with their research and radio presentation, The History of Art, Humans.
Okay, we've been walking for 3 miles. Are we almost here? This better be good.
Yeah, look, it's right up there. We're just gonna go inside. It's gonna be awesome. You're really gonna like it.
Really? I hope so. I mean, at least it's gonna be cold in there. So we're in this random cave in Lascaux, France. God knows, anyone knows where that is. I'd much rather be in Paris, but I'm trying this out for you. So, can you tell me where these paintings are?
Maybe you should stand up and look around, and you might see something.
Oh, that's pretty cool. What are those, bowls?
Oh, yeah. So we're looking at some nice bowls that were painted in 25,000 BCE by cavemen. And
wait, 25,000 BCE? How are they still intact?
Well, not many people travel in caves, so they've literally been intact for so long. Plus, they're made out of charcoal and natural materials, so there's not much wind or anything to really disrupt them.
How did they even get up there?
So, a lot of people don't know this, but cave painters actually built scaffolding to reach the ceiling. And they also found, when people were exploring these caves, they found lanterns that were actually used to help them see. So, actually more advanced than you might have thought. Olivia?
Oh, sorry. I'm just looking around. It seems that there's so much history here.
Well, yeah, this is where the history of art is fabled to have begun.
Really? Right here? Right where we're standing right now?
Yep.
Wow.
Hey guys, thanks for joining us this week. As always, this is Molly.
And this is Olivia.
And today we will be talking about art and nature. What do you think they have in common?
I don't know, Molly. What do you think?
I don't know. Let's find out. The Hall of Bulls and other caves is where art is believed to have started. Through this art, man was connected to nature. What we are wondering, and what we will discuss during this show, is whether or not that connection has been strengthened or weakened through the evolution of art.
So let me ask you this. Who knew nature better, modern photographers or cavemen? How did they express their understanding of nature?
When thinking of art and nature, one thing that immediately comes to my mind is definitely the landscape paintings of the mid-19th century. Famous artists of that time, I think, included Thomas Cole and Frederick Edwin Church. They were both part of the Hudson River School, which was a group of artists dedicated to portraying their surroundings and beyond. This kind of movement was a transnational movement. They had landscapes anywhere from the Hudson River Valley to the Dutch countryside. Like oil paintings were often on huge canvases, some even up to 10 feet long.
Okay, so they must have been outside painting for a long time, right?
No. Some of these painters never even saw the landscape they painted. They just based it off their imagination and other religious influences.
Oh, they must have had pretty wild imaginations.
Yeah, definitely. In these paintings, there's often sublime imagery meant to show the divinity of nature.
So it seems like these artists wanted to portray the ideal nature rather than how nature is realistically.
Yeah, I think that too, but it seems that as time progressed, the artist's depictions of nature became less idealized and more realistic, but I mean, it's so hard to say that.
Can't speak generally about art, right?
Yeah, I mean, it goes in so many different directions mm-hmm. and styles.
Took the words right out of my mouth. Well, we've left France completely.
And now we're hitting the streets of Easton, Pennsylvania to find reactions of strangers to this hyperrealist work.
And we're going to see if it blows their mind, because it blew my mind. Did it blow
your mind? Definitely blew my mind.
All right, let's do it. So these aren't photographs.
Yeah, these are insane. These are paintings?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my god. That's unreal. Oh my god.
Imagine if you saw that.
That's not. I'm sorry, that's real.
Oh my god, the detail on that.
Hyperrealists are perfectionists, to say the least. Their works look like photographs, so it's almost impossible to tell the difference between art and real life.
Wait, don't most of them base their work off photographs?
Yeah, so they don't have to spend long hours studying their subjects, but they definitely have to study their photographs, right?
Yeah, so you can kind of say that they're two levels away from interacting with nature, but I mean, honestly, it must take so much skill.
Oh, yeah. So, cave painters, they drew on walls, and landscape artists painted on canvases, but hyperrealists paint or sculpt their works based on photographs that are based on nature.
Finally, on to our last topic that brings us to the present.
And what is that?
Modern environmental art, Molly. Get with it.
Oh, my bad. I guess I got caught up in the hyperrealist stuff. I haven't really been paying attention since then.
And that is the goal of the environmental artists.
What is?
The modern artists use the natural landscape as their canvas to advocate for current environmental problems and to try to get people to pay attention to them.
Oh, okay. I think I've heard about some guy who does that. I think his name is Adam Silverworth.
Close. It's Andy Goldsworthy. He's definitely a popular environmental artist. He used the landscape around him to emphasize the importance of being connected with nature. This is definitely something that he feels society has lost. So whether his work is temporary or permanent, it is constantly interacting with the changing environment.
If his work is temporary, then how does he share it with the public?
He uses photography and film.
So his art is all about the impermanence of nature, but he uses technology to make it permanent. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, because, I mean, not everyone can visit the specific location of his sculptures, so this technology is a benefit that, let's say, cave painters didn't have. If someone wanted to visit the cave painter's art, they would literally have to go to the cave.
Right, that was actually the problem. In 1963, they shut down the Hall of Bulls and actually took 20 years to build a replica nearby, and now that's what tourists visit. They can't actually go to the real Hall of Bulls because so many people were trafficking through there that they were destroying the works.
So technology can really connect us to the past and keep it alive for future generations.
It's actually really amazing. We can see something that was done 1 year ago, or we can see something that was done 27,000 years ago. Like, that's such a crazy, expansive time to actually be able to witness. So let's try and revisit that question we asked in the beginning of the podcast and figure out the answer.
What was that again? I forgot. I'm getting caught up in all this history and nature.
Well, we've pretty much have been talking about it the whole time. Who was more connected to nature? Cave painters or landscape artists, hyperrealists, or modern environmental photographers?
Oh, crap. I really thought we were going to be able to get an answer to this, but there's so much new information that I really can't come to a conclusion.
I think that's the point. All artists know nature, whether they paint a sketch of a ball on a wall or an exact replica of a woman in a bathtub. Each artist understands their subjects on a personal level.
Yeah, all these artists knew their individual subjects well, even if they didn't reflect every single aspect of nature in their work.
That's a good point. So there really isn't a definitive answer to the question. These artists all understood nature to the same extent, but just chose to represent it differently. This brings to mind a really good quote by the hyperrealist painter Lee Price, and it really seems to embody this idea.
I don't believe there is much of a difference between the conceptual, the abstract, and the figurative. There are different modes of communication, but in the end, you get to the same place. It seems to me that all art is about taking an idea and making it concrete.
Wow, she really sums it up nicely, better than I could ever.
So that actually really makes me think. Could you say that all humans are nature, then?
Yeah, that seems like a fair claim.
And so if all humans are nature, then any connection with a human would be a connection to nature, right?
And isn't that all we do?
Well, that's what this is right now. So I guess we could say that this podcast is art.
Well, I think we should leave that one up to the audience.
As Molly and Olivia explained, art reflects our view of nature, and art can also be a reflection of our surroundings. It's easy to see the connection in art that clearly uses nature as its subject. Think of the paintings of the Hudson Valley School. The images of lush forests, winding rivers, and towering mountains have come to dominate our opinions of what nature should look like. As Molly and Olivia went along the timeline, this opinion of nature varied, as did the art. Now we transition to a radio show based in Easton, Pennsylvania, at the prestigious Lafayette College. This show focuses on how we come to know nature through the hard facts of science. In this particular episode, hosts Vinay, Matt, and David ask their professors, who each specialize in a different scientific field, if they believe there's any chemistry between science and nature.
So the interaction between science and nature, I would say, is they're kind of one and the same.
Science is a tool that allows us to understand nature.
They intertwine sometimes, but they're mostly separate.
And welcome back to Our Natural Environment. My name is Vinay.
And I'm Matt.
And we were just discussing the relationship between nature and science, and all of the different ways that they can be compared and contrasted.
All right, don't jump ahead, Vinay. First, let's introduce the show a bit more. All right, in just a sec, we'll go back to talking about the differences between the two.
What we have planned for you today are some opinions on the topic of science versus nature from experts in their fields, and then opinions of students. Next, we'll take callers to hear their opinions on the matter. And finally, we plan to discuss some of the impacts that nature brings to all of us in our everyday lives.
Yep, so let's start out with the differences. Some popular comparisons in regard to nature include that it is organic, animated, and cyclical, whereas science is mechanical, dead, and linear. Science needs to be organized and precise to be considered real science, and nature is more unpredictable. Nature is not man-made. There are mechanics to it, believe it or not.
That's ironic.
That it is, Vinay, and it is the mechanics that scientists understand to help the average Joe develop his personal interpretation of this natural world.
That's right, Matt. Science is, in one sense, our knowledge of all that, all the stuff that is in the universe, from the smallest atom in all living things to the nuclear reactions that form the immense ball of yellow gas that is our sun. But just as importantly, science is also a reliable process by which we learn about all of that other stuff in the universe. However, science is different from many other ways of learning because of the way it is done.
So, basically what you're saying is that science helps satisfy this natural curiosity with which we are all born with. Why is the sky blue? How did the leopard get its spots? What is a solar eclipse? With science, we can answer such questions without resorting to such magical explanations.
Very good point, Matt. Scientists can tell you all about cell reproduction of a prokaryotic organism, but meteorologists can't even tell you when it's going to rain. That being said, we wanted the opinions of more people, so we went out with some correspondents in the field to talk to several more people about their opinions of science and nature. Today, we will be interviewing scientists from two major branches of science, biology and chemistry, and getting their take on this phenomenon of the relationship between nature and science. Let's cut to our correspondent, Robert Storm, who is at Hugel Science Center talking with Professor Robert Kurt.
Mr. Blue Sky, please tell us why you had to hide away for so long. Where did we go wrong?
Thanks, Vinay. And you were right about those meteorologists. Last night they called for sunshine, now I'm standing here looking like I just got out of the ocean. Anyway.
So we're here with Professor Kurt, head of the biology department at Lafayette College. Professor Kurt, what is your view between science and nature?
So this is kind of easy coming from a biologist because I view biologists as studying life, and life is inherent in nature, interacting with nature. So the interaction between science and nature, I would say, is they're kind of one and the same from a biological perspective.
So from a biologist standpoint, nature and science are one and the same, meaning they are interdependent upon one another. It makes sense. Without nature, scientists would have nothing to study, but without scientists, the everyday person would not know the mechanics of nature or the in-depth way that nature works. Before I go off on a tangent, let's hear the perspective of a chemist. Here's our correspondent, Michael Gust.
There's hydrogen and helium, then lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon everywhere, nitrogen all through the air, with oxygen so you can breathe, and fluorine for your pretty teeth, neon to light up the signs.
So we're here with Justin Hines, a chemistry professor at Lafayette College. Professor Hines, from a chemist's perspective, how do you view the relationship between science and nature?
So I think that nature is extremely complex and mysterious, and I think that science is a means of knowing things. It's a tool that allows us to understand nature. And I think the most important thing that science can do is to help us not delude ourselves about the way that nature is, that we have all these intuitions about the way the world should be, and we usually find that our intuitions are wrong. And so we can't rely on those intuitions. We use science as a way of clarifying the truth from our misconceptions.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Back to you, Vinay.
Wow. So without science, the modern world would not be modern at all, and we still have much to learn about it. Millions of scientists all over the world are working to solve different parts of the puzzle of how the universe works, peering into its nooks and crannies, deploying their microscopes, telescopes, and other tools to unravel its secrets. This kind of relates back to the questions you asked earlier, Matt, like, why is the sky blue, or why does a leopard have its spots? Specialized fields of science work tirelessly to understand mysteries as to why the world behaves as it does. You know, there are in fact some natural mysteries that science can't explain. Black holes, the Bermuda Triangle.
Speaking on that topic, I recently read an article about the mystery of the Bermuda Triangle being solved. Most incidents actually occur because of the past methane explosions that cause methane bubbles to form that essentially trap ships and planes and bring them underwater.
That's an interesting theory, Matt, but despite your attempt to disprove me on my own show, sir, it's most likely just another idea as absurd as aliens or the Gulf Stream theory.
But that's a topic for another day. Let's hear from the perspective of an economics professor. We have our correspondent, Tom Fields, down at the Simon Center. Tom, take it away.
Thanks, Matt. So, I'm here with Professor Guy. Professor, tell me, what is your opinion on the relationship between science and nature?
I think that science has a role to play in working with nature, but I think the way the world has evolved, commercialism has overtaken the higher values that science could have had as an influence on nature. And sadly, science has turned the interaction into more of a commercial prospect instead of a wholesome endeavor.
This is an interesting perspective, too. It sounds like she's saying scientific experiments seem to be performed more for financial interests than the actual love for nature or desire to find out more about our world. It makes sense, seeing as most scientists have more money than what they know what to do with. I recently interviewed a freshman at Lafayette. Let's hear what he has to say on the topic.
Okay, we're here at Lafayette College, Watson Hall, with first-year student Andrew Skirbo. Andrew, how do you view the relationship between science and nature from a student perspective?
Well, frankly, Matt, I really don't think they're related. Science is mechanical, while nature is more environmental. They intertwine sometimes, but they're mostly separate, and therefore I don't think they're related.
Okay, so it sounds like... Oh, it appears we have a caller. Hello?
Hey guys, my name is Dave Biggers, a research analyst at Keep It Green Incorporated, and I recently read an article regarding the processes of fracking and harmful effects of scientific obstruction on the environment just to obtain natural gas. Is it really worth the price of water pollution, earthquakes, and more emissions than coal? The two aren't related. Science is a mere bully to the environment.
Really? Can you explain a bit more?
Well, you see, people today have two options. To accept that scientific understanding of the natural world is all measurements and observations, or to accept the traditional understandings of the world made by people who only had the tools of their eyes and imaginations.
And why can't there be a third option of accepting that the primary goal of scientists is to make new discoveries or develop new theories to progress toward a better understanding of nature?
Progress toward a better understanding of nature? Remember what Professor Guy said? Yeah, the only green they care about is the amount of in their pocket at the end of the day. It's commercialized.
Really? Well, if we didn't have geneticists, we would not know the nature of our genes or how to prevent, say, certain diseases. Without biologists or plant scientists, we would not know how to increase the agricultural output to nutritionally enrich the inhabitants of the natural world. Without earth scientists, we would not know how to predict natural disasters, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes. In other words, knowledge that can help avoid hardships that have plagued humanity for centuries before us. In this world where economic competition is rising by the minute, science is nothing short of an investment for a better, more efficient natural world.
Well then, why when a scientist makes a new discovery, it's the only thing we regular people hear about on the news for days on end?
because it changes the thought process of people and their perceptions of nature. Whether it be a new dinosaur or how atoms bind, scientists find their greatest joy in discovering something new or explaining a problem that could previously not be explained. Thus, people now have a better understanding of the natural world or how the natural world works around them. Hello? Hello? Well, it looks like we lost the connection. Actually, this is convenient. Let's make that our question of the day. So listeners, what are your thoughts? Is science overpowering the environment, or do they have the capability to work in harmony? Keep that in mind.
Well, that caller pretty much explains the presumptions of the rift between science and nature. Anyway, have you heard about that typhoon that struck the Philippines a couple weeks ago?
Yes, Typhoon Haiyan. It's quite tragic. The current death toll is just over 5,000. I feel they could have prepared for the storm more than they did.
Believe it or not, they did evacuate 3 days prior to the storm. I think the magnitude was just underestimated.
Well, how did they know to evacuate?
Well, science. From satellite images to the Doppler radar, meteorologists have come a long way in predicting storm surges, measuring the magnitude of them, and even discovering preparative techniques for those who may be affected. Think of how high the death toll would have been without 3 days forewarning to evacuate. Scientists today can track storm days in advance to determine the size and impact it will have on the designated location.
You know, earlier in the show, I claimed meteorologists couldn't even predict when it was going to rain. And according to our correspondent, Robert Storm, I was right. Surely these forewarnings can't be exceptionally accurate.
Well, yeah, that's the one problem. Accuracy. Think of all the factors that have to go into predicting a storm. The route, the intensity, and the time component. The route accuracy improves as the storm moves closer to shore. However, the intensity and the time of arrival are nearly always unpredictable because of the different factors that attribute to it. Water currents, air currents, and even temperature can strongly impact the intensity of a storm.
I see. I suppose some warning is better than nothing at all. In any case...
Excuse me, Vinay. By the way, guys, if you would like to help the relief effort in the Philippines with a $10 donation, please text Red Cross to 90999 and then confirm the donation with the word yes. Any help would greatly be appreciated.
Indeed. Well, that's just about all the time we have for today. So thank you for listening. And don't forget our question of the day. Is science overpowering nature, or do they have the capacity to cooperate? We want to hear your thoughts, so send us your responses at ournaturalenvironment@gmail.com. I'm Vinay.
And I'm Matt. Thanks for listening, guys. Until next time. Carry on, I need to get back to the place. Let's go. I'm coming home.
This just in, I'm receiving a transmission that we are now switching over to a technology podcast that will be covering a similar topic of the comparison between technology and nature.
Ha! I guess the newsroom had budget cuts. Without further ado, here's Connor, Kevin, and Charles with Technology and Nature.
Hi, I'm Charles Verhoeke, and today on Getting Technical, an interesting question has come to us from a listener, Chris Putnick from Illinois. Chris asks the question, is it good or bad to use technology to understand nature? Normally, we deal with technological advances, but I feel this presses on a very important topic of the morality of using technology. To get a general insight on how people view technology, I have gone out into the field and interviewed them on how they see technology in their own lives. What comes to mind when you think of technology?
Information comes to mind.
When I think of technology, I think of computers and cell phones.
Computers.
Robots.
I think of computers, TVs, and cell phones.
Computers.
How does technology affect your life?
I use it every day, so it has a huge influence on my everyday activities.
Technology affects my life because it allows me to connect with other people.
Makes it faster, and I can broaden my horizons on topics that I've never even thought of thinking about before.
On those days I don't really have anything to do, but technology provides me things to do.
It allows me to learn from news around the world.
I use it.
What does technology mean to you?
Technology means... information and advancement.
It means advancement in our civilization.
It means a broader perspective on life.
It means having something to do on those days where I don't have anything to do.
It broadens my horizons. It
means a lot of things.
It seems that most people contribute technology to their phones and computers. This makes sense due to the increasing prevalence of these technologies in our lives. Walking through the streets, it is commonplace to see people absorbed in their phones and not even looking out into the world that's around them. They also mention that it broadens their horizons and allows them to do things that they wouldn't previously be capable of doing. These all seem pretty positive towards using technologies, but this was just a small sampling from some strangers. I brought Kevin from Hippie USA and Connor from Nature Publishing Group to give us an insight into this debate. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Charles.
Thanks for having us.
So, what are your guys' backgrounds?
Well, I went to Cornell University for 4 years, then I went to Columbia Graduate School, and now I'm working at Hippie USA writing.
I graduated from Bechtel University, and I've been working with Nature Publishing Group ever since.
So the viewer-submitted question is it good or bad to use technology to understand nature?
Technology has become a massive part of our lives, especially in recent years, and I believe that this has isolated us from nature, takes us away, because nowadays people would rather look things up on their phone, take out their phone, Google something, rather than experience nature for themselves, rather than going outside, going to a park, literally being in nature and experiencing it for yourself. So much knowledge is learned through personal experience, so if you only use your phone or technology to learn these things, then do you really understand it? Do you really come to know it? I don't think so.
I actually think technology can be really beneficial in many ways. You said how technology can remove us from nature and isolate us, but I think it actually has the capacity to bring us a lot closer to nature. Technology allows us to experience things we never would have normally been able to experience. Even if we don't have the means to physically go to a place, we can still experience it through photos or videos. For example, I could pull up a video of the Amazon rainforest in seconds on my phone, or take a virtual tour of the pyramids of Egypt. It just allows us to see nature as something obtainable, something that can be brought to everybody and experienced by everybody at relatively little cost.
I don't know about the Amazon rainforest or the pyramids, but I'm looking online all the time on Facebook and other sites seeing what my friends are doing.
I don't think that what you said has any relevance, Charles, because I'm not really talking about Facebook or websites like that, but moving on to the broader point of technology, I would say that technology and, like, the things us humans have done has been astonishing. Like, the things we've accomplished over the past however many years with technology has been, it's been amazing. But people need to really personally experience more, actually get out into the world, go see something outside, leave your house, go travel to a different country. People need to personally experience way more, because way more is learned through personal experience rather than technology. Like, I'll give you an example. Charles, what's the weather like today?
One second, let me just check my phone here.
See, I can't even believe that you said that. There's a window right behind you. You could have looked outside, been like, it's sunny, there's maybe some clouds, so maybe I'll throw on a sweatshirt today. Could have done that.
Well, I think my point actually did have a lot of relevance. I can see what my friends were doing.
Okay, Charles, calm down. It's okay. Okay, Kevin, I get what you're trying to say about the window thing, but what does that really matter? Does Charles gain anything by looking out the window instead of looking at the weather on his phone? Just because the way we do things has changed doesn't mean it was a negative change. But I think the biggest benefit of using technology to understand nature is that technology allows us to see just how beautiful and fascinating nature is. It lets us, by doing research and things, it lets us see nature as an intricate web of different systems, all working side by side to maintain balance and produce the things that we see in nature. Using technology, I can do all kinds of research about different ecological principles or relationships between species. And these things give me a much greater understanding of nature, and it makes me feel more connected with nature. And once I understand nature, it pushes for conservation-minded thinking, makes me want to protect nature.
With technology, we can definitely broaden our horizons and research all different sorts of topics and research basically everything that we need to. But
when you make the point about conservation and that all this information makes us want to appreciate it more, it makes us want to conserve it, preserve it, but is all this technology really conserving our nature, preserving our nature? I don't think so, because we've created so much electronic waste at this point that we don't even know where to throw it out. It's just, it's becoming such a problem for our environment, because things like electronic waste, it doesn't evaporate, it doesn't go away after a time. It just stays there and just sits in our natural world, just rotting. So I don't think that all this technology has become good for our world.
That's right. Throwing out your technological waste is a huge disgrace. Well, I want to go back to our Facebook conversation that we were having before.
You know what? Just to make you happy, Charles, I'll talk about Facebook. In the interviews played at the beginning of the show, some students were talking about how it can make their lives faster, easier, and connect you to more people. Like, I think that's true. I think that Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever you want to spend your time on, all the pictures or videos that you see on these websites, are you really experiencing these things for yourselves, experiencing nature for yourself, or are you just merely visualizing it, looking at it? I think that personal experience, going outside, going anywhere, rather than just looking at a picture on someone's screen, is a lot more valuable.
But see, at least you're able to see these things, even if it's just a picture or a video. That's much better than not seeing it at all. I feel like social media can be really beneficial in terms of your perspective on the world and nature specifically. Technology can expose you to all different kinds of people and ideas from around the world. And all of these people have the ability to offer you unique perspectives about nature, about the world. To give a specific example of how technology can help nature, someone could use social media to promote a conservation or nature rehabilitation organization, spread the word about these natural principles, and just get the word out there.
Oh yeah, I think I liked a post on Facebook the other week that was like 5 likes, and they donated like $10 to charity. It's awesome.
Charles, you realize that they're probably not actually donating money to charity, right?
Thanks, Connor. Now that I'm, like, clinically depressed, I could use a trip somewhere. To somewhere like Bermuda.
Speaking of your trip to the Bermudas, I think this is a good time for us to segue into our topic of transportation and understanding nature through transportation. In our world today, at least in the world that I live, we don't even see the land that we travel across because we're either in a plane, in a car, in a helicopter, whatever transportation methods you choose to use. Rather than back in the day when people just had to pick up their things and travel on foot and literally walk across and personally experience every single bit of land that they walk across, rather than like what we do today, we're just flying on a plane. Next thing I know, I'm in San Diego, California, and I didn't even know that I passed over Kansas at one point. It's like going from building to building without even seeing anything in between. How am I supposed to learn about the land that I live on if I don't even see the land that I live on, if I literally just travel over it in a car or something? How am I supposed to learn and come to understand nature through that land?
I don't know if I could do that. I get sore walking from my dorm to Ecopian.
Charles, that's actually kind of pathetic. But back to Kevin's point. It's true that cars and planes might physically remove us from our environment, but you're missing the benefit of them, which is that we can go anywhere we want. Back thousands of years ago, people rarely moved, like, 10 miles from their birthplace. They were stuck in that one area. Now I can jump on a plane and go anywhere I want. I can go to the Amazon rainforest. So essentially, transportation lets us view nature as something obtainable, something that can be brought to us, something that everyone can experience. If I wanted to go to the rainforest and study monkey behavior, I could do that. So basically, the fact that technology opens all these doors for us, transportation does, kind of overrides the fact that it might detach us from the environment a little bit.
Well, this has been a really eye-opening discussion here. It's been awesome having you guys on the show.
Thanks for having me, Charles.
You're the best, Charles.
Well, that was quite an interesting debate. It seems that this question isn't so simple after all. You can't just use technology to understand nature. It's more of a balancing act. You have to use technology to see nature in a certain way, but you also have to go out and experience it by yourself. That way, you can get the most amount of information you can while also being able to judge and see nature in your own light. I hope you're satisfied with that answer, Chris. Now, if you want to submit your own question, send it to us at questions@gettingtechnical.com. Now, a word from our sponsor, Hex Gears. Hex Gears' new ultra-thread gears will leave your mechanical systems running smoother than ever with only half the lubricant needed for normal gears. For a discounted price of 10%, and to let them know we sent you, enter in the discount code LE3NO9 at checkout. Now let me repeat that. LE3NO9. And for all of us at Getting Technical, I'm Charles Verhoeg. You stay classy, Internet.
The idea of knowing nature through science and technology might seem strange. They are not so easily regarded as ways to know nature because, to some, science and technology might even seem the complete opposite of nature. But we really don't notice how much science and technology have really come to dominate our way of knowing nature. In the past several decades, we have trusted science and technology to provide us with accurate information about the natural world around us. The knowledge and resources these two ways provide have become an integral part of our lives and have seriously affected how we view, interact, and know nature.